1 Kings chapter 11, and we'll just read it, verse 29. You remember Joe talked to us last week about how at the end of Solomon's reign, God raised up adversaries, and one of them was internal. And that's what we'll read about now in verse 29. At that time, when Jeroboam went out of Jerusalem, the prophet Ahijah, the Shilonite, found him on the road. Now Ahijah had dressed himself in a new garment, and the two of them were alone in the open country. Then Ahijah laid hold of the new garment that was on him and tore it into 12 pieces. And he said to Jeroboam, "Take for yourself 10 pieces. For thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I am about to tear the kingdom from the hand of Solomon and will give you 10 tribes. But he shall have one tribe for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, the city that I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel. Because, and this is why this will all happen, because they have forsaken me and worshipped Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the god of Moab, and Milcom, the god of the Ammonites, and they have not walked in my ways, doing what is right in my sight and keeping my statutes and my rules as David his father did. Nevertheless, I will not take the whole kingdom out of his hand, but I will make him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of David my servant, whom I chose, who kept my commandments and my statutes." And then look down to verse 38. You'll see that Ahijah delivers this promise, and it's important to think about what we're going to read here in these couple verses. This is what Ahijah tells Jeroboam. In verse 38, he says, "And if you will listen to all that I command you, and will walk in my ways, and do what is right in my eyes by keeping my statutes and my commandments, as David my servant did, I will be with you and will build you a sure house as I built for David, and I will give Israel to you. And I will afflict the offspring of David because of this, but not forever. Solomon sought therefore to kill Jeroboam. But Jeroboam arose and fled into Egypt to Shishak, king of Egypt, and was in Egypt until the death of Solomon." And then verse 43 tells us Solomon slept with his fathers and was buried the city of his father, and Rehoboam, his son, reigned in his place. And then just we'll read the beginning of 1 Kings 12. Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel had come to Shechem to make him king. And as soon as Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard of it, for he was still in Egypt, where he had fled from King Solomon, then Jeroboam returned from Egypt. And they sent and called him. Jeroboam and all the assembly of Israel came and said to Rehoboam, "Your father made our yoke heavy. Now therefore lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke on us, and we will serve you." He said to them, "Go away for 3 days, then come again to me." So the people went away. And we'll talk a little bit more about what happens in the interim, but I'll just read now in summary, verse 16, what happens ultimately when they're rejected by Rehoboam. "When all Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, the people answered the king, 'What portion do we have in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Look now to your own house, David.' So Israel went to their tents, but Rehoboam reigned over the people of Israel who lived in the cities of Judah." We trust that the Lord will bless the reading of his word along with what we'll consider later. So I could have read a lot, actually. There's a lot I'd like to have read. If you look at these chapters in Kings, I think probably for most of us, they're probably not the most worn pages in our Bible. I think a lot of us we'll read the beginning of Kings about Solomon, and then we skip to Elijah and Elisha. We don't spend a lot of time necessarily on all of the kings that we have here in the book of Kings, and as well as we have in Chronicles. So just a couple introductory comments with Kings. I think there's three primary themes, you could say. One, you see that the Lord judged Israel and Judah because of their disobedience. And we read some of that in this passage in 1 Kings 11. You can see as well, and we'll see through some of what we consider tonight, the word of the true prophets always came to pass. When God delivered a message through them, it was faithfully executed every time. And then lastly, and this is a key thing which we'll see throughout these entire books, the Lord remembered his promise to David. We see that the Davidic line is preserved, and that's in the kingdom of Judah. Now, one thing as you go through these portions of Kings, there can be chronological challenges. There can be some differences sometimes between historical records as far as time frames. And really some of that can be explained by that there likely at that time there were some periods there were co-regencies. In other words, you had two kings ruling simultaneously. You know, one example of that might be with Asa, and we'll talk about him a little later. But Asa was very ill at the end of his life, and scholars would tell us that he made his son Jehoshaphat a co-regent for the last years of his life when he was very ill. So that would help explain perhaps some of the time differences that you may see. What you'll have in each of these passages, though, you've got an introduction to each king. And this slide, I'm not going to read through all this. It just shows you some of the facts and some of the details that you'll typically find as each one of the kings is introduced. Now, one thing to look at these when you're reading through this is to how the kings are referenced. And this can be confusing. It was to me years ago. But it helps until you understand this, that typically they're going to reference, first of all, the king that's serving in the opposite kingdom. So, for example, you'd read, in the third year of Asa, king of Judah, Baasha, the son of Ahijah, who was the previous king of Israel, began to reign in Tirzah. So it's telling you that the third year of Asa, the king who's ruling over in Judah, Baasha, rose to the throne in Israel. Then it'll tell you later on in that same chapter, in the 26th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ella, who was the son of Baasha, he began to reign in Tirzah. So it's important to understand how the names kind of go back and forth and how they relate to one another. And then for each king, typically you're going to have some summary comments. You know, there'll be a notice of their death, perhaps their burial. But then as well, you will get additional details in the book of Chronicles. Chronicles will provide additional details, particularly in some of the moral aspects of the kings. And of course, the parallel passages, though, in Chronicles are only for the kings of Judah. So they will not include the kings of Israel. So just to look from a historical context, where we're starting from and where we're going to. This is a summary chart I put together for all of the kings. So you have 19 kings of Israel in the north, the northern tribes. Then you have the kings of Judah in the south, where you have 20 kings there. Now, I've listed how I like this breakdown. You can see the pink is kind of the bad, green is good, and yellow is a mixture. So it's easy to remember for the kings of Israel. I can help you count there. There's zero good kings. There's no good kings in Israel in their entire history. It's only failure time and time again. When you look at the kings of Judah, it's a little bit of a mixture. I've highlighted four that are identified as good kings, and then you have four that are a mixture of good and bad. Now, I would say as well, though, I need to be clear, when we say good or bad, you can't speak completely in like a superlative. It's not completely true all of the time. For example, Rehoboam, we would list as a bad king, that he did evil in sight of God. But actually, Rehoboam, he starts out after his initial issues, he has 3 good years, and he serves the Lord pretty well for 3 years. But then he abandons the Lord. So it's... you got to remember that people aren't consistently the same. So just as there, some of the bad kings may have done good things on occasion, but it's a general characterization of their life. You'll also see when you look at this, of course, the tribes, the kings of Israel, they finish out before the kings of Judah. And that's because really what you'll see, I can show you on this slide, I like to kind of show you how they split and then what happens, where you can see when they have captivity here in Assyria, when the Assyrians take them captive, they cease to exist at that time. But then the kings of Judah continue on until they're taken away in captivity and then ultimately returned. And then if you like lists, you can always go back for reference. Here's another list that will show you kings of Judah. This is a list of the kings of Judah, which will indicate how many years each of them reigned and then the approximate dates. So what we're looking at tonight are the first three. We'll be looking at Rehoboam, Abijah, and Asa. And then if you look at similar lists for the kings of Israel, you can see their time of reign listed for each king. And you'll see tonight we want to cover the first six, Jeroboam, Nadab, Baasha, Ella, Zimri, and Omri. And you can see there Zimri had a reign of 7 days, so he didn't last very long. If you look, when we talk about some of these, you'll see when you look at the kings, especially of Israel, in my mind, it's very much like feudal France or feudal Britain back in those days, where it's all about gaining power and killing and consolidating power. And it's very similar to that, like sometimes what you see in politics even today. But here's where we're starting from before the kingdom splits. So this is something similar to what Joe showed us last week. You'll see the kingdom of David, Solomon, and Saul. So Saul's kingdom is in the green in the middle. And then you see under David, the kingdom expanded to include all of the purple region, and as well under Solomon, the lavender region. But as we read in 1 Kings 11, the seeds of problems were sown under Solomon, where he turned his heart towards idols, and the people of Israel began to worship idols under Solomon. So a couple of things I would think about what we read about Solomon there. One, it was just like we heard from Dan 2 weeks ago on David, where David started well in middle life. He had some problems. Solomon was the same. Solomon started well, but he didn't end well. And it's something we can take into account for ourselves. We can fail at any time. Don't assume that I'm standing sure and that life is good and I can just coast now. That's not true. That if you think you can just coast, then you're in trouble and you're looking for failure. The key point with Solomon certainly is his wives led him into idolatry. He loved his wives, and they'd led him astray to worship idols. You know, and I think that would bring it to mind for us. We have in 2 Corinthians 6, to not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. That's never God's will. And that's going to take you into difficulties and problems. But ultimately, and this I think is one of the themes that you see throughout Kings, while Solomon was a tremendous king, he had tremendous intelligence and wisdom. He had wealth and power like no other king. But yet, ultimately, God is sovereign. And God declares in chapter 11, because of Solomon's disobedience, the kingdom is going to be taken from him or from his descendants. And that's what we had with Jeroboam in this passage. So we read about Jeroboam there. Now, who is Jeroboam? So Jeroboam, he didn't come from a royal lineage or anything. He was a common person, a common man, but he was a man who had talent and skill. And Solomon, he worked for Solomon. Solomon put him in a leadership role, building the Milo, and then he was elevated even further, where I understand that he was responsible then for the tribes of Joseph, or Ephraim and Manasseh, for their leadership of the workers in those tribes. So he was a man of some skill. But Ahijah, the prophet, he delivers this promise from God to him that because of Solomon's sin, 10 tribes are going to be given to Jeroboam. And then, as I mentioned to you when we read that, it's tremendous. He's told, you know, if he'll be patient, if he'll be faithful to God, God will bless him and his family, just as he promised to bless David. Now, as I look at that, you think about, remember we read, what was Solomon's response? Remember we read, Solomon hears about it. We're not told how Solomon learns of this, if Ahijah spoke to him or if he just heard about it. Solomon hears about it and seeks to kill Jeroboam, but then flees to Egypt. You know, when I think about that, that shows me, in one sense, how far Solomon has sunk. When you think about David. You remember when David was confronted by Nathan? What was David's response? David responded that he'd sinned. And he writes a psalm here and says, "Against thee, God, have I sinned, and thee only." David acknowledges his sin and repents. In Solomon here, you see no sign of repentance at all. It tells me how far Solomon is away from the Lord now at this point, where Solomon, rather than saying he's sinned and he should turn from the idols and turn to God, he wants to kill Rehoboam and to thwart what God has said he's going to do. So now, who is Rehoboam? So we'll talk about Rehoboam a little bit. This is Solomon's son. He's actually the only named son of Solomon that we're told about in the scriptures. And Rehoboam was 41 years old when he began to reign. And at this time, we read how Jeroboam and Israel came to Rehoboam with a request. They said, "Your father Solomon was very hard on us. He taxed us heavily. He made us work hard. He made us work too hard. If you'll be easier on us, we'll willingly serve you." And then Rehoboam actually does a wise thing at this point. At this point, he tells them, "Well, go away for 3 days. go away for 3 days so he can consider this matter and make an informed decision, then come back and he'll give them his decision. So first of all, in chapter 12 and verse 6, we'd read, he speaks with the older counselors who served his father Solomon. And the older counselors, what they tell him, the older counselors tell Rehoboam, if you'll listen to the people and if you'll make their life a little easier and take care of them, you'll win their hearts and they'll serve you forever. You'll be their true king. But we're told, we could read that Rehoboam rejects their counsel. Instead, he talks to his friends, his younger friends in verse 8, and they tell him the opposite. They tell him, you ought to show the people how strong you are as a king. And they kind of give a phrase. They say, you should tell them that Solomon, my pinky is thicker than Solomon's thigh. And really what that's saying is, my little pinky finger is stronger than Solomon's leg. That's how tough I am. And they tell them, Solomon disciplined you with whips, I'll discipline you with scorpions or scourges, something more severe. So I'll increase your workload. Now, a key thing here is this last point. He talks to the older men, he talks to the younger men, but one thing he never does, he never seeks advice from God. He never goes to the Lord and asks God what he should do or how he should respond to the people. So then, as we read, after that response, we see then that there's the split in the kingdom. And the kingdom is split in two. You know, and you think about, this is one event in history. You know, there's a saying that sometimes you might hear, that mighty doors swing on small hinges. And that can be true. That big, huge changes can occur as a result of a small thing. And that's what happens here. As a result of this decision, as a result of the actions that Rehoboam took, there's tremendous consequences immediately and then for hundreds and hundreds of years for the children, for Israel, where the kingdom's divided now. And then there's going to be war, there's going to be much killing and bloodshed and much difficulty in idolatry. So you see essentially the First Kings, really, it's a house divided. So a couple of lessons from Rehoboam's decision that I would say we should take for ourselves. So something that we can benefit from looking at what he decided. So first of all, seek the Lord's will. And I've put two proverbs up here. This is from Solomon, from Rehoboam's own father, who said, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him and he will make straight your paths. And that should be our thought as well, that we should seek the Lord's will. And then as well, I think it is wise to listen to others. You know, Proverbs 11 and 14 says, where there's no guidance, a people fails. But in the abundance of counselors, there's safety. You know, instead of making decisions all on your own, there is wisdom in a multitude of people. But he also says that this last verse is good. The glory of young men is their strength, but the splendor of old men is their gray hair. You know, and that would relate in one sense to kind of what we have teaching for us as believers in the New Testament. You can think about Titus, of how we're encouraged to go to older believers for advice and for help and for guidance. And that's really what this verse is telling us, that the young men, the glory of young men, really like the ones you went to, that's their strength. They don't have the same experience. But the splendor of old men is because they've lived a life. They have experience and knowledge that they can draw from. And then lastly, it's key to think, as you saw in this case with Rehoboam, that our choices can have tremendous impact and they can create tremendous results. You know, I won't talk much about this, I'll just say that it's true that what one sows, one will also reap. You know, that's a principle we have in the New Testament. And that decisions and that we make and the way we treat others can have lasting impacts. Small things can create big changes. So Rehoboam, we talk about him a little more. Now, after the kingdom splits, he's going to reign 17 years. And just to show you how he operated, first of all, the first thing he does, he sends Adoram to Israel. Now, Adoram is the man who's in charge of all his labor. And you wonder, is that really a good idea? When the people are so upset with him because he won't reduce their burdens, instead he sends his taskmaster to go talk to them. So what happens? Well, they stone him to death. So when they stone him to death, Rehoboam gets the message, and he turns around and flees from Shechem back to Jerusalem, where he's going to be safe. And there we're told he gathers his army. He's going to restore the kingdom back to one under his rule. And he puts together an army of 180,000 from Judah and from Benjamin. But again, this is a case of where God sends one of the prophets, a prophet to him, sends Shemaiah to him and tells him, don't fight, stand down, this is of God, don't leave. And actually, and this is where I say, Rehoboam did good. Rehoboam listened to the prophet, he listened to Shemaiah, and they do stand down. And then he's going to have 3 good years after that disastrous decision. We could read that he obeyed God there. And we see as well that he fortified the cities, he provided leadership. But then the big thing that he does is his last point in a spiritual sense, where Rehoboam in the kingdom of Judah, he receives the priests and the Levites from the north. As they're all fleeing from the north, because we'll talk more in a few minutes about Jeroboam and his false religion. So you have these priests that are coming down to Judah, and they're willingly received. And then there's a time of spiritual prosperity where they are truly following the Lord. But, unfortunately, if you go to 2 Chronicles, you'll read in 12 and 1, when the rule of Rehoboam was established and he was strong, he abandoned the law of the Lord and all Israel with him. Well, Rehoboam completely turned from God and turned to idolatry. And what you see there actually is what we read a little bit about the fifth year. In the fifth year of his reign, Shishak, the king of Egypt, the man where Jeroboam had fled, he invades at this point. He's much more powerful than they are. He invades. He invades the tribe of Judah. And the results of that are, well, first of all, as they're being destroyed, ultimately they finally come to a place of repentance where they confess. In 2 Chronicles, you can read about Shemaiah coming to them, and the men admit that the Lord is righteous. The princes of Israel and the king humbled themselves and said, the Lord is righteous. And God stops Shishak from totally destroying them, but they are going to be servants to Shishak from now on. They're going to serve Shishak. And then the big thing, too, you remember you heard under Joe last week, of how silver was counted as nothing and all the gold that we had in Israel. Well, Shishak takes away all their gold and all the treasures. That all goes back to Egypt with them, and they're left with nothing. So what does Rehoboam do? You remember the shields of gold that we heard about last week? So Rehoboam, he replaces the gold shields with brass shields. So now you have shields that were solid gold. They're made out of brass, a cheap metal. It's lustrous. It's shiny, but it doesn't have the same value as gold. And that'll be something that'll remind them. He actually has the guards use them daily, take them in and out, and store them as they did before with the gold ones. So in one sense, it'll be a reminder to them every day of their failure and of God's judgment upon them. But we need to look at Jeroboam. So Jeroboam is in Israel. And you'll see quickly that from Jeroboam, there's no trust in Jeroboam in God's promise. Remember, we read that God had promised him, if you'll be faithful to me and follow me and obey me, I'll make your house like David's house. The first thing he does is he creates a false religion. Jeroboam has no trust in God, and Jeroboam, he's concerned because Jerusalem is where the temple is. And Jerusalem is just south of the border between the two tribes. And Jeroboam, he thinks, well, the people are going to want to go worship the Lord. So they're going to leave the north and go to Jerusalem. And if they go to Jerusalem to worship, they won't come back. So he decides the best thing, and this is something that you'll see Satan, a tactic of Satan constantly, so he provides a substitute for them. So Jeroboam creates 2 golden calves. It would remind you almost of Exodus. And he puts them in 2 locations for convenience. So one of them's going to be in Bethel at the south of the kingdom. It's only about 12 miles north of Jerusalem. So you won't need to go all that way to Jerusalem. Then the second one he installs in Dan at the top of the kingdom in the far north to make it convenient for you. You don't have to leave your house and make a big journey. just go to the convenient location and worship at that place. The other thing he does as well, he establishes his own priests from the people. They're not from the tribe, but they're not Levites. He's creating his own, basically his own religion. He's an imitation of what is true. But then also, he's going to go even farther, where Jeroboam, he assumes the role of a priest, and he's offering incense on an altar. And he's confronted at this point by a man of God from Judah. There's a man of God who's come from Judah and confronts him and tells him that he's done wrong. And he actually tells him that in the future, a descendant of David, Josiah by name, will kill the false priests and burn them on this altar. And this actually happens 300 years later. Now, Jeroboam, when he's told this, he's outraged. So what Jeroboam does, he reaches out his arm towards this prophet and to tell his men to seize him. And he reaches out his arm, though, God seizes up his arm. His arm is frozen. He can't move his arm now. So Jeroboam, then he asks the prophet, plead to God for me that he'll restore my arm so I can have use of my arm again. And the prophet does that, and Jeroboam gets the use of his arm back. So Jeroboam tells the prophet, come back to my house, you can eat dinner, and I'll give you a reward for helping me. Now the prophet, he tells him, I can't do that. Even if you gave me half your kingdom, I won't do that, because God told me directly not to eat or drink here in Israel, and to go back home a different way. So I can't do that. So then he leaves. And now this is kind of a different story that you have here in chapter 13, which maybe is a little bit difficult to understand in some ways, where another prophet that lives in Bethel, and this prophet, he tells him, come back to my house and eat a meal with me. And the prophet says, I can't do that, because God has told me to go directly back home and not to eat or drink here. And the prophet tells him, well, God sent an angel to me. God sent an angel to me, and the angel told me to invite you to my house. But he was lying to him, and that's what it says. But he lied to him. But the prophet listens to him, and he does. He goes back and eats with him, and then the prophet from Bethel understands from God that this man is going to die. And so then the prophet, as he leaves, he's gone his way back now. After he's done this, he's killed by a lion, and actually a lion and his donkey that he's riding on just stand over his body. And it's rare, you would think the lion would tear his body to pieces, but it doesn't. So the prophet of Bethel knows that this is the man of God, that God has judged him. And he kills him, so he brings him back and he buries him in his grave. Now, it's kind of a different story, but the one thing I would take from that, it would apply to all of us. It can be difficult to understand. We don't know why the one prophet did what he did, why he lied to him. But I think it's clear. When God gives you clear direction, you don't disobey it. You know, and that can be true for us today. You know, there are people today that may tell you, the Bible doesn't really say this. You saw that from Satan, didn't you, in Genesis 3 with Eve. You know, did God really say that? No. And that's kind of what we can take from this. When God gives us clear direction, we need to follow it. We can't ignore it and assume it's another truth. And people will do that today. You know, an example, it may be heinous in some sense. You think about the sin of homosexuality. There are people that will try to say, well, the Greek and Hebrew doesn't prohibit that. That's talking about a polygamous relationship. It's not talking about monogamous. But that's completely false. It's not true. And we need to recognize that whenever God gives us clear teaching, we need to follow it. But while Jeroboam, so he continues to reign in Israel, and then here in chapter 14 is an interesting story where then his future is going to be prophesied, where his son Abijah, he has a son Abijah, young son Abijah who's sick, and he wants to find out what's going to happen with him. So he sends his wife to Ahijah the prophet, but he tells her, disguise yourself. Don't let him know that it's you, that you're my wife. But God tells, he's almost blind, and she comes to Ahijah, and he tells her the terrible prophecy that your husband has been wicked, he sinned greatly against God, and he tells him effectively that all of your descendants, all the males in your family, they're all going to die, and none of them are going to be buried. They're going to die. They're going to either be eaten by dogs or eaten by birds. And he says, and as far as your son, she says, go to your house. When your feet enter the city, the child shall die. But in one sense, you can see the mercy of God as well, because he says as well here, all Israel shall mourn him and bury him, for he only of Jeroboam shall come to the grave, because in him there is found something pleasing to the Lord, the God of Israel, in the house of Jeroboam. There's something in this boy that pleased God, and God in his mercy saw that this he would be buried, but he would be the only one in Jeroboam's family that would be buried. And lastly, the last thing to say about Jeroboam, and I think Luke mentioned this in ministry maybe a month ago, Jeroboam does seem to set the standard for evil. When you read it, the rest of the kings, a common description at the end of each one is he followed the deeds of Jeroboam and went in the ways of Jeroboam and was wicked as Jeroboam was, where Jeroboam sets the standard for evil in the kingdom of Israel. So this is kind of what we have right now then in the divided kingdom. So you've got Judah in the south, Israel in the north. You can see up here by Dan, that's where one of the idols was. The second one was here in Bethel, which is about 12 miles north of Jerusalem. So let's talk about Abijam now. So Abijam is the son of Rehoboam, who will reign after Rehoboam dies. He only reigns for 3 years. We're told he's in a continual war with Jeroboam. But it's interesting, and this is where you see some differences. In 2 Chronicles 13, he's called Abijah, not Abijam. Now, Abijah, I understand that means my father is the Lord. And the story that's recounted in 2 Chronicles 13 is more of a positive nature. It talks about a battle at Mount Zemaraim where we have 800,000 from Israel versus 400,000 from the tribe of Judah. And that's where Abijah, he speaks to the people and he tells them, why will you fight against the Lord? God has made this promise to David and to his descendants. You shouldn't fight against the Lord, but there is a tremendous battle. And actually, there's 500,000 from Israel. 500,000 of the 800,000 are slain, where God miraculously wins a tremendous victory. Now, in one sense, I was thinking about that. It's kind of hard to wrap your head around that number. I mean, sometimes we kind of read over this and don't even think what that means. But I looked a couple things up. So the Vietnam War was a time that's considered a terrible war for us in the U.S. Well, in the Vietnam War, we lost 58,000 soldiers. That's a long ways away. If you look at World War II, in World War II, the United States, we lost 416,000 soldiers over the whole five years of the World War II experience with modern warfare. So here in one battle, 500,000 men from Israel are slain. It's just tremendous destruction that you read there. But he seems to be faithful there. But yet, in 1 Kings 15, we're told he's called Abijam, or the father of the sea. And we read there that he followed his father's example. He walked in sin. And we're told clearly that his heart was not wholly true to the Lord. And so Abijam passes from history. So now you'll go to Asa. So Asa is your first good king. Asa is the first good king that we'll read about in Judah. And Asa is one who's the son of Abijam. He reigns 41 years. So he reigns a long time. And his first 10 years, we would read, Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as David, his father, had done. It's interesting. He removes all the idols. But it's even more interesting, in one sense to me, we see that he removed his mother from being queen mother. His mother had actually created an Ashtaroth idol, and he destroys that, burns it, and scatters the ashes over the brook Kidron. But then he removes his mother from her role as queen mother. And really, that's a tremendous lesson, I think, even for us, where Asa, he puts God first. He puts God first ahead of his family, ahead of his blood relations, ahead of his mother. I mean, most of us, you certainly have loyalty to your mother in most cases. But yet he recognizes his mother had done wrong, and he removes her from that position. And then we're told that he had peace. So for those first 10 years, he enjoyed peace, that it was a time of peace and prosperity and a time of spiritual blessing where the idols had been removed and they were worshiping God. Now in the next 25 years, it begins with there's an Ethiopian invasion. And this is tremendous when you think, you see the faith of Asa here. The Ethiopian invasion that you can read about in 2 Chronicles, there's a million soldiers that come from Ethiopia to attack Judah. He has an army of 580,000, and he's surrounded by them, and he cries to the Lord for help, and he depends on the Lord. Now, when you think about that, that's a huge number of people. I looked up, just to give you a reference point, if you look up Wayne County, Michigan, so most of us here live in Wayne County. I know a few would live outside of Wayne County, but Wayne County includes 48 cities, townships, and communities, includes Detroit, Livonia, of course, Northville, Canton, Plymouth, Westland, Dearborn, all surrounding communities, but 1.75 million people. So that's essentially, at this battle, you're talking, it's almost like every single man, woman, and child in Wayne County is ready to go to war. And that's what you have here. And Asa, in faith, cries to the Lord for help. And the Lord wins a tremendous victory for him. We're told that all of the Egyptians died. Ethiopians died, excuse me. A million of them. They're all dead. They're all destroyed. And then there's great spoil. And really, I think part of this great spoil, that allows Asa to then bring back gold and spoil back to the treasuries and even back to the temple, where he now has more wealth. And it's followed by peace, because he's been dependent upon God and he's obeyed God. But now, unfortunately, Asa, like Solomon and maybe like David, to some sense, he doesn't end as well. So the last 6 years of his reign aren't quite the same. First of all, Baasha, the king of Israel at that time, he's creating a blockade where he's trying to build a fortress city just north of the border. He's going to control passage in and out of Judah. And it's going to have an economic impact, and have an impact upon them. And Baasha, actually, he's in an alliance with Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria. So what Asa decides to do, rather than depend on the Lord like he did with the Ethiopian invasion, it's not even a fight yet, but he's concerned about what might happen. So Asa comes up with the idea, I'm going to go to Ben-Hadad, and I'll pay him more. If this guy's a mercenary, he'll fight for money. So he empties the treasuries, gives him gold and gives him treasures, and gets Ben-Hadad to turn on Baasha, and then the war is averted there. But then as well, in his last years of his life, he has a disease of the feet, we're told in Chronicles. And perhaps some might think it could have been something like gangrene, where he had some kind of tremendous infection he ultimately dies from. And we're told there in Chronicles that Asa, when he had this terrible disease, it says he didn't seek help from the Lord, but he sought help from the physicians. So he talked to his doctors and towards those health people, but he never asked the Lord for help. So we see how Asa ended at that time. So if you look at Asa's rise and fall, let me just go through this very quickly. It's kind of matched almost stage by stage, where first he sought the Lord, he's attacked by Ethiopians, he relied upon God. His faith was commended by Obed. His devotion was even greater, and he had peace. And then he's attacked by Israel. He relies upon Syrians instead of God. His lack of faith in God was condemned by Hanani the prophet. His rebellion was even greater. He had wars, and he didn't seek the Lord when he had physical issues. And of course, the first six there are the first 35 years of his reign, and the last are the last 6 years of his reign. So that's Asa. Then Asa dies, and then you'll hear more next week from Jeff about Jehoshaphat. But a couple lessons from Asa. One would be trust in God, not in man. You saw that Asa in his life, that he relied on the Lord early, and God blessed him for it. Psalm 118 says, out of my distress I called on the Lord. The Lord answered me and set me free. And then you see how, again, in the 39th year, he didn't seek help from physicians. So Psalm 118:8 says, It's better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in man. And that's really what Asa did at the end of his life. He put his trust in man and his ideas and in the physicians instead of in the Lord. So next, we switch back to Israel, and you've got Nadab. So Nadab is Jeroboam's son. He's going to become king in the second year of Asa. He follows his path, leads Israel to sin. And we're told here that this is where, under Nadab in 2 Chronicles 11, the Levites left their common lands, their holdings, came to Judah and Jerusalem because Jeroboam and his sons cast them out from serving as priests of the Lord. Jeroboam and his sons utterly reject the Lord and God's teachings. So actually, there's a town, Gibbethon, and it's a town in Dan that bordered the Philistines. Nadab is there with his army seeking to take it back. And at that point, Baasha, he's likely a military officer. We're not told for sure, but he kills Nadab and he takes the throne at this point. So after 3 years. So Baasha ultimately then, he fulfills what Ahijah had prophesied to Jeroboam's wife. Remember, I told you that. So what Baasha then proceeds to do is he kills every single male and every single male friend in Jeroboam's family. And they're all killed and wiped out at this time. And really, it's sad in one sense to think about here. So this ends the first 24 years of the nine dynasties in the kingdom of Israel's 250 years. And essentially, you've got both these dynasties now, this dynasty is wiped out and everybody's gone. So Baasha now takes the throne in Israel. And so the throne in Israel, again, at this point, it's in Tirzah. And that's where they're serving from. So Baasha was he's a revolutionary. He was from the tribe of Issachar, who killed Nadab, and he destroyed the house of Jeroboam. He reigns for 24 years. And there's continual war between Baasha and Asa. And this is where, at the end, as I mentioned, he builds Ramah of Benjamin, 5 miles north of Jerusalem, in working with Ben-Hadad. But then Asa, again, as I mentioned, under Asa, he bribes Ben-Hadad and breaks off with Baasha. So Baasha retreats to Tirzah after the attack from Ben-Hadad. When you think about Baasha too, though, one thing about him to mention, he didn't kill Nadab and Jeroboam's family out of zeal for the Lord to be righteous. Really, he did it out of a thirst for power. And it was all about gaining power. And Jehu, the son of Hanani, tells him in 1 Kings 16, the same kind of thing, because Baasha is just as evil. Anyone belonging to Baasha who dies in the city, the dogs shall eat. And any one of his who dies in the field, the birds of the heavens shall eat. So you're going to have a similar fate for Baasha. Because after he dies, his family, Ella takes the throne then at this point. Ella is a son of Baasha, who rules for 2 years after Baasha dies. And really, we're not told much about Ella. There's only about two verses that talk about Ella, the king. And it's kind of sad what it talks about, though. We're told that Ella, he is in a drunken state. He's drinking himself to be drunk, and he's killed by Zimri, who is likely the commander of half of his army. So as you think about him, I think about this. So this is a king who's characterized by his drunkenness. And that's the only thing we read about him. And I think, as when I think about it in my mind, about Zimri taking his life in this way, I would tend to think, maybe it wasn't the most well-planned coup, but if you're going to have a coup or attack the king, you're probably going to have some planning associated with that. It's not something you're going to just do on a whim. So I would think that this indicates is the character of Ella, that he was drunk probably all the time. And Zimri knew that. He could plan on, he's going to be drunk, and I'll have the opportunity to take his life, which he ultimately did. You know, in Proverbs, Solomon wrote himself, "Wine is a mocker, strong drink a brawler, and whoever is led astray by it is not wise." You know, in Ephesians, we're told for us today, "Be not drunk with wine, wherein is excess, but be filled with the Spirit." So we would take from that, to me, that we should be controlled by the Spirit of God. So the best course of action, I believe, for a believer is to stay away from wine and alcohol. Stay away from it. You're not necessarily prohibited from ever having a drink of wine, but it can lead to a lot of problems and a lot of difficulties. The best thing is to stay away from it. You know, we're to be under control by the Spirit of God. And I would think, to me, that would apply today as well. I know marijuana has been legalized here in Michigan. I think it would apply the same there as well. It doesn't mean because it's legal that I should be out smoking pot because it's legal now. No, I should be under the control of the Spirit of God. And as you saw with Ella, bad things happen when you're under the influence of other agents. So Zimri, in his short span, he immediately kills all of Baasha's male relatives and friends, just like had been prophesied that would happen. So he does that, and now here it's in less than 50 years, the first two dynasties end, and their families are completely exterminated. There's nobody left behind of those first two families at this time. So Zimri reigns in Israel again. As I mentioned, it is very brief. Zimri, maybe he thought that when he took over, maybe the people would follow him, but that really doesn't happen. We read that Zimri reigns for 7 days. There's the army that's at Gibbethon, the city that borders the Philistines, and there you have Omri, who's the general of the army there. So Omri is there, and the army there doesn't agree that Zimri is going to be king. Instead, they decide, no, we're going to make Omri king, our general here. He's going to be king instead. So Omri and the troops that are with him, they leave Gibbethon, and they're going to come back to Tirzah. And at that point, Tirzah is surrounded, and Zimri doesn't seem to have much recourse, so he basically commits suicide. We're told Zimri, he burns the palace down on top of himself. So he lights the palace on fire with himself in it and dies in the fire and commits suicide. Now, when you think of the name Zimri, really it means traitor. And I put up here like Benedict Arnold. That's what his name actually meant if you were a Jew. You know, you could say to for us as an American, if you say you're a Benedict Arnold, you would all think about, sure, the spy Benedict Arnold, how he betrayed his country. Well, that was the same way that a Jew would think about Zimri, that he was a traitor. And even you see that with Jezebel. You may hear more about him next week. But as Jehu entered the gate, Jezebel tells him, "Is it peace, you Zimri, murderer of your master?" And really, you Zimri meaning you traitor. So that's how Zimri now is thought of. He's thought of as simply as a traitor. So now, wrapping up, the last king of Israel we'll talk about tonight is Omri. So Omri is now going to be king of Israel. Now he starts out, he's going to reign for 12 years. The first 4 years are going to be difficulty because actually he's fighting. Tibni is another man that he controls about half the people, and they're fighting among themselves for control of the kingdom until ultimately Omri dispatches him and he consolidates the kingdom for himself. And he's an evil king. He rules for 6 years at Tirzah, but he is a wise man. He purchases the hill Samaria, and he fortifies that. He builds a fortress there. It's on a hill, and he thinks he can be protected there. It's a good defensive position. So he makes Samaria. It's going to become the new capital of Israel, and you'll read about that now more next week and in future weeks, where Samaria now becomes the capital for Israel. Now, you see that picture I've got there? That's actually a stone that you can see in the Louvre if you go over to France. It's from the Moabites, and it talks in there about Omri, the king of Israel, that he was one who caused difficulties for the Moabites at that time, that Moab was oppressed by Omri, king of Israel. So during his reign, there actually is peace with Judah at this point. And as I mentioned, he forms alliances with surrounding nations. But the ultimate conclusion for Omri is this. Omri did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and did more evil than all who were before him. For he walked in all the way of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and the sins that he made Israel to sin, provoking the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger by their idols. So that's who Omri is. And Omri, one thing he's going to give us, and Jeff will tell you about him next week, his son Ahab, who will take wickedness to a new level in the kingdom of Israel. So just to end, I wanted to show you this summary. I like this. It kind of shows you the two kingdoms. So on the right, you can see the kingdom of Judah, where you had the line going through as promised by God. And this is where I think you can see God honors his promise to David, that your kingdom shall be sure, your throne shall be established forever. And David, Nathan told these words to David. And this is what you have fulfilled here in this tribe. You can see that there is no, there aren't dynasties, there aren't people overthrown. It is one continuous succession from David. But you can see over here on the side over here with Israel, you can see these lines. So, for example, Baasha, he's not part of that dynasty. He just overthrows Nadab. And you can see that continues throughout there. So in closing, I thought to end on a more positive note. I think it would have been good for the kings then, and it's good for us today as well. I thought this was good to show. This is what a quote from the Lord Jesus himself. With the Lord, he summarized the commandments here in Matthew 22. And he says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself." And you can look at this quote from the Lord Jesus and think, if the kings had lived this way, if they had put the Lord your God above all else, there would have been a much different situation. And that would have been true as well, as I mentioned up front, with Jeroboam, where Jeroboam had a tremendous opportunity, but he rejected it. So the Lord tells us this as well. This should be our position as well. We have put the Lord first in our lives. And then secondly, love your neighbor as yourself. So that's the history tonight for these first kings here in Judah and Israel. And hopefully this will be of help to you. And let's close in prayer now.